Hello, I'm Jack Underwood.
And I'm Rachel Allen.
And you're listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast. On this week's show, we have Ray Almontrout and Dom Patterson in the studio.
And audio postcards from Daljit Nagra, Sylvia Legree, and Zayar Lynn, translated by Coco Thet.
Hello, my name's Daljit Nagra, and that was the sound of a newspaper. I am currently standing on a newspaper, and I have a newspaper above my head. I am a newspaper sandwich, because opium has been in the news of late, and I have a poem about opium that I wrote a few years ago, and it's a news broadcast, and my favourite BBC journalist goes back in time to report about an incident. So it's called The 13 O'Clock News. Pip-pip! Today's feature for Monarchy Month is the first Indian knighted in 1842. His name is Sahib Sir Jamsetji Jijiboy. But why was a queen keen to knight a native? The answer lies with the man in a red phone box, the arch liberator, the truth sleuth. You know him as every lady's tonk honker, John Simpsonian. Ho, John Simpsonian, do you zoom boom for us? Pip pip! Our connection is scrambling. I'll be brief. This self-made good chap had a checkered midlife. It seems that in opium wartime, Jijiboy ran the speediest clippers bound for China. As you see, I've landed at the port, at the Yangtze Gorge. Those hordes of mangawood boxes are Jamsetjis. And the men with machetes are unloading each box with brown balls inside as big as a commie lady's breast. Oh, John Simpsonian, through gyres and galaxies, you're the boldest Zumbuma. If I may sum up, in this dim, droopy night, the lovesick mass of men lined along the bank as the whole nation of John Chinaman and Shangri-Landers was sleepwalking for a toke, a cut, a suck of the dream of empire.
That was an audio postcard from Daljit Nagra, who will be appearing as a guest in a few shows' time. And Jack, who do we have in the studio today?
In the studio today, we have Don Patterson. His poetry collections include Nil Nil, God's Gift to Women, Landing Light, Rain, and 40 Sonnets. He has published two books of aphorism, The Book of Shadows and The Blind Eye, as well as translations of Antonio Machado and Rainer Maria Rilke. He's also the author of Reading Shakespeare's Sonnets, Smith, A Reader's Guide to the Poetry of Michael Donaghy, and the poem Lyric Sign Meter, whose poetry has won many awards, including the Whitbread Poetry Prize, the Geoffrey Faber Memorial Prize, the Costa Poetry Award, and all three Ford Prizes, and the T.S. Eliot on two occasions. He was awarded the Queen's Gold Medal for Poetry in 2009. He's a Fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the English... Should I read all of this? This is getting a bit silly.
You must
know
the scratch cards.
Well, I'll persevere. Since 1997, he's been a poetry editor at Picador Macmillan for many years. He's also worked as a jazz musician and composer. He lives in Edinburgh, but he's hit the train tracks today to come and visit us in London. Welcome, Don. Would you like to kick us off by reading a poem?
Sure, Jack. Lovely to be here. I'll read. I've got this new thing coming out next year, which is and the poem's based on the first season of The Twilight Zone. So I'll read one of these. Some of them are quite distant from the original episodes, but this is called The Deal. I have never read it out before. The Deal. You're in luck. I find myself unexpectedly good for souls this week, having just corralled an entire crap arts colony of English hipsters in San Miguel. Sit down and make yourself comfortable. You'll enjoy this for once. I'm going to tell you something that will make you rejoice in your own inevitable death. I can feel you braced to be underwhelmed, but it's none of that death lends an immediacy and presence to being bullshit. No, you will rise from the couch feeling lighter, stranger, and altogether otherwise. Like that first time you took mushrooms or read Kafka or got the call she'd dropped dead in the street. Things are about to take a remarkable turn for you. And if you love your life just as it is, maybe you should leave the office right now. Okay, I'm overselling it. It's just I'm all jizzed up with the novelty of the situation. Let's get to it. What is it in the scheme of things? Your span, I mean. When I give someone the choice of 500 years or immortality, you'll be unsurprised to hear they all choose the latter. Might as well, they think. And when they say, so what's the catch? And I say, like I was quoting them for drywall, in return you will give me your soul, they correctly assume I'll get it after they die, and then double check just to be very clear on that point. So it seems an easy finesse. Just don't die. And I'm fair. I say, you sure about that 500 years? About not even having a death to bore yourself to? Are you really using your soul much anyway? To be honest, anyone that rolls up in this place really isn't, so the question's kind of answered itself. But no one ever gives up in their eternal eternity. Almost no one. Just once I had this guy sit and think and fold and walk, even after I'd thrown in riches beyond your wildest imaginings. I believe they were a games theory strategist for the Chinese military. Then I grant them their wish before the time to change their mind, then I leave them to figure it out. On average, they ask me to kill them within about 2 hours. A few last a couple of days, but the smarter get it almost instantly, and they're gone before lunch. You what there? So it turned out death was the only thing that made sense of anything. Not even close, kid. I mean, sure, your consciousness, let's call it the sense of yourself, is predicated on its own finite term, so you need the illusion of a time-limited goal even to wipe your ass. That much should be obvious. No, it's this. Without death, this place becomes the hell it is. The place that only death was protecting you from. I've watched what happens to their brains in that first hour. It's close to smoking Sonoran desert toads, and therefore in part involves, I'm guessing here, it really isn't my expertise, the stored up DMT you'd be holding back for your actual death being released into the healthy mind. But the truth is, it's more like the subtraction of a trip, the one you call your life. Forever, by the way, turns out not to be a thing. All you have is a precise nowhere, a presentless now. And at that point, you know the summary absence of time, space, and your place within them is not a holiday from which you will return with your snaps and tan and local fruit spirit and your tale of how you learned that man are we irrelevant in the cosmic scheme of things. No, what you discover at that instant is that your finite term meant time had scale. A clock is a clock because of the clock inside you, which you've just destroyed. Imagine looking at that red chair in the corner and having no way of knowing if it were an inch or a mile high. Or, close your eyes, this is a party trick of mine, if the sound you're about to hear is a whisper or a distant scream. I know, right? Now internalise that if you can. Sensationalise it. How does it make you feel? Like a ship at sea. That's the worst you can come up with. Good God. No, untime is not a featureless churning sea into which the happy little steamboat of the self is thrown like a cork. It is the vast underocean wherein that ship can sink but never die, only find other watery hyperspaces to drown in and drown again. It is an alien extrinsic horror such as no shred of conscious mind should be permitted to know. Listen to me. You think I was H.P. Lovecraft. Anyway, I hope you got the gist of it there. So they beg, and I'm kind and quick about it, and I don't gloat except with the worst of them. What do I do with them? Well, the human soul is highly high-grade material. They're worthless, a bundle up for resale like subprime mortgages. But the others, truth is, I can't tell you, as I really would have to kill you, but it's nothing particularly bad. Contrary to popular, as a mere instrument of physical law, I've better things to do than recreational torture. In those last hours, most of you have suffered enough. Anyway, if you think your life has little meaning now, and I know you do, or you wouldn't have answered the ad, you really want to try 5 minutes of immortality.
Rae Armantrout is an American poet generally associated with the language school. She has published 14 books of poetry and was awarded the 2009 National Book Critics Circle Award for her book of poetry Verse, which has also been nominated for the National Book Award. She later earned the 2010 Pulitzer Prize for poetry. Her most recent book is Wobble, published by Wesleyan Press, and is also a National Book Award finalist. What poems would you like to read for us today?
I think I'll read Flicker from Wobble.
Great.
It's in two parts. Flicker. When it was them, our parents, dying, the way they tried to deny what was happening, the way they were angry at the wrong things, seemed of a piece with the way they'd always been wrong about us, we thought. The way they were wrong about the world, which they saw only through the haze of their own swath of the past. so that it seemed natural for us to scoff, inwardly, even at their deaths. But now it was one of us threatening to get up and walk out of the hospital on his withered legs, sheer sticks, because it was killing him. Clouds of methane rise from dumps outside our city. As I drop a square of soft cheese through a slot into the bin marked landfill. Of course I feel bad about feeling good, about feeling bad about this. But as time speeds up, everything will flicker. And the second one will be The Craft Talk. It's a prose poem that I wrote when I was asked to deliver what's called a craft talk, in which the poet usually discusses his or her ideas about what poetry is or what it should be. And I always find myself very ambivalent on that subject. I mean, I have some ideas, but my confidence level is low in my ideas because they change. So I did this kind of, it's a bit of a spoof on thinking through a craft talk. The Craft Talk. So that the best thing you could do, it seemed, was climb inside the machine that was language and feel what it wanted or was capable of doing at any point, steering only occasionally. The best thing was to let language speak its piece while standing inside it, not like a knight in armor, exactly, not like a mascot in a chicken suit. The best thing was to create in the reader or listener an uncertainty as to where the voice she heard was coming from so as to frighten her a little. Why should I want to frighten her?
Thank you so much for both of those readings. So we ask all of our guests to bring in a small item that might be indicative of their poetic practice. Who would like to share there?
You go first.
I lost mine in my bag. It's there somewhere.
Is that indicative of your poetic practice as well?
Unfortunately, it may well be. It was a piece of pool chalk.
Oh. Well, it doesn't matter if I actually find mine or not, right? Because right now it's not turning up. But of course, you can't see that on the radio.
So perhaps you've both lost your...
Yes, but I can tell you the story of how I acquired mine.
Uh-huh.
This sounds like I was taking your suggestion rather lightly, but at lunch they had some flowers on the table, and you know, so I stole a leaf from the plant and brought it because I find that inadvertently, perhaps I put a lot of there are a lot of references to leaves and plants and the shadows they create in my poems, not in those I read right now, but. It's not a thing I carry with me. I don't carry it a leaf around like a talisman and then stare at it. But I do often look out windows, like many people do, and sometimes I'm struck by the movement of leaves.
And one of my favorite poems of yours, actually, The Emotional Life of Plants.
Oh, yeah.
Which seems to fit quite well with the plucking a leaf from a restaurant table.
That's a pretty technical poem about actual, you know. It turns out that plants, in order to photosynthesize, use quantum physics.
Wow.
So it's about that.
Yeah.
I could read that, or I could read a sort of more normal, accessible poem that would involve leaves somehow. Would you like me to do that?
I mean, I love that poem, The Emotional Life of Plants, so much. Maybe we should read that one in a bit, but we should also talk about, Don, why you had a bit of pool chalk as your small totem.
Well, it's it's a rubbish totem, it's not, but I don't really do talismans, I suppose. But I thought, you know, what comes up every day when I'm writing, and which is an excuse to stop writing. So, and that's my standard excuse because I'm a US pool nut and I have a pool table in the front room. So, if I sit still for 20 minutes, I'll go and play a frame. And
you must be really good at pool.
Bad to be absolutely. I think I'm crap at everything else, but I'm not a bad pool player.
The ferryman a true story? That's one of your where you play yourself at pool, or it's a sort of uncanny conceit where you might not be.
That's true. That happened pretty much.
You cleared it all up.
Yeah.
One break. What's it called when you pot all the balls in one go?
It's called pieing all the balls in one go.
That doesn't sound like a very technical pool term.
It's called clearing the table, I think.
Okay, so yours is kind of an idea of an escape from writing poems.
Yeah,
Actual physical break.
Well, also because it's just, you know, because I like conceiving of things as a pool game, and it's just like, you know, you know how there are certain things you do repetitively in a way that sort of it means that you kind of internalize them sort of eidetically. So I can see a guitar if I close my eyes, and I can play that in my head. Mm. I can play pool in my head, and I tend to. Everything kind of goes through those two things, and pool's just like karma. It's all sort of cause and effect, and it's always your responsibility if you screw up. And
does that come back to your idea of writing your own poems and perhaps an editorial process?
Totally, yeah. So it's a confined kind of rectangle within which, you know, sort of you do X and Y will result. So I do see.
Is there a kind of like obsessiveness about that, because it's returning to the same place for different results and or like having some kind of structure? I think about like, I think maybe, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I remember reading that when you, just before you turn in a manuscript from a book or during or at proof stage or something, you make a little window viewfinder and check that there aren't any acrostics saying like bum or something. You know, is that true that you read the poem backwards?
I may have said that sort of in a jocular way once, but I don't think I did. It's a good thing if you're proofreading, though. I mean, it's an old proofreader's trick, which is you cut a kind of letterbox and you move it backwards through the poem. Huh. So you decontextualise everything and you can spot typos that way. But
Probably sent a whole generation of Patterson scholars searching the first letter of every line for
acrostics.
yeah, exactly.
I guess I think the first question I'd like to talk to you both maybe about sort of poetry and how you position yourselves with contemporary poetry is to talk about maybe how you both see yourself as working within the kind of generic contemporary lyric mode, which is obviously a very contested, difficult to define space. But I think, you know, if I say it, we can all know what we're talking about, sort of an address from a singular lyric I with a sort of audience overhearing what's been being said to something else. And I think about your claim, Don, in your brilliant essay on sound and sense, where you talk about a claim for logic that can be gestured to or inherent in sound similarities in poems. And you say words are so indivisibly part sound and part sense that the patterning of a sound alone can generate sense as if it constituted a syntactic relation, which I found absolutely extraordinary considering your poems, which can be so reflective and representational of something that's actually happening, for them to also to be gesturing to another kind of sense. I found it really brilliant. And Ray, obviously your poems, you know, I've been reading them for a very long time and I've read so much of your work, and they consistently shift grammars and syntax and alter verbs and nouns within the poem to create this kind of dislocated kind of sense that exists within a lyric framework. One of my favourite sort of things that you said about clarity in poetry is, but clarity need not be equivalent to readability. How readable is the world? And I think about your poems in that sense as a kind of obfuscating, but also sort of reflective matter. And I just wondered about your preoccupations, your sort of career-long preoccupations with the lyric and with lyric address and experimentation in your very different areas of poetry.
Well, I often start writing a poem when I feel puzzled by something. You know, I sort of start with a question, although it isn't always a formed question. Sometimes it's just the sense that, oh, that's odd. There's something there, something I don't quite understand. Let me follow it out. I don't know if that relates to the lyric or not, but I like poems that leave you thinking and that therefore are sort of open-ended, I suppose. And in terms of the lyric address, that's, of course, really complicated. I think most lyric poems, there are exceptions, of course, don't really directly address the reader. I mean, traditionally, they address some kind of inaccessible beloved, or God, who's another kind of inaccessible beloved, I suppose, nebulously positioned. And so the in a way, the addressee isn't really present, is never really present. And so that's a kind of lonely position. So I suppose I see the lyric as that kind of speaking into the void, as if the void was, you know, had an ear. And then there's the problem of the self, because as I'm speaking in a poem, it just seems to naturally happen that my I that I'm speaking from changes. Sometimes the pronoun I refers to something close to my own feelings and thoughts, and sometimes some other voice comes in. And since I don't see myself as writing dramatic poetry, that other voice is just another speaker who takes over the poem for a minute.
Yeah, I love how you seem to shift perspectives, I think, in your poetry with your kind of moving between pronouns. And it almost deals with the kind of ethical implications that can arise, I think, with speaking to or for something in an otherwise quite mm-hmm. standard lyric address.
Another idea about lyric is that it's generally short. Another idea is that it highlights sound, that sound is important in it. And those are both true of my poems. Short is obvious. As for highlighting sounds, I mean, sound is important to me. I don't know if everyone sees that or hears that, rather, in my poetry, but to me, it's a very salient factor. When I'm composing, I say my poems aloud to myself. And I sort of echo something that you were saying that Dawn had said in an essay. It seems to be the case that if something sounds good, it will also sound true. And sometimes I play around with that. I make something sound good when it's dubious whether it's true or not, just to kind of test the proposition. So there are ways of kind of being within the lyric and still pushing against the traditional boundaries of it, I suppose.
Well, I found so much of what Ray was saying just echoes my practice, really. You know, I've actually not got much to add. I mean, I'm the same, you know, just like I'm usually kind of irked or puzzled by something. Otherwise, I wouldn't write the poem, and the poem is a way of working out mm-hmm. what I think about that. That hunch or that confusion. And it's a way of making some kind of sense. And because, as you say, it doesn't fall within the kind of the usual easy category of what's true or false, you make it true by singing mm-hmm. it, by making, you know, some kind of musical unity of the thing. And for some reason, that provides a kind of a logic that also convinces others, really. It's because you project song as to project your voice in that way. The only worry is, you know, is the fact that sometimes you might find yourself saying things that aren't true and making them sound convincing by dint of the fact that you've made some lyric weave of the whole, you know, which is the key to political sloganeering, of course. I mean, that's why mm-hmm. that stuff works, is because it falls easily and correctly on the ear.
And mm-hmm. sometimes poetry's
a pernicious lie.
Sort of hyper-aware of that, I think. Yeah. It's a self-reflexive mode, I think, quite naturally. It often just tends to critique itself. It's so easily broken.
Yeah, it depends on the poem.
Yeah, not everyone does. I mean, I do that. And I deliberately sometimes make something that will sound true on first hearing, and then you'll go, wait a minute. And I think it's that I want to model that kind of double take, because there's so much in the world that we need to do a double take on and take a second look at.
Right? Do you think that's part of poetry's kind of political importance? And that's always a slightly sort of grey term.
And its responsibility, because you hear people talk about the poet's responsibility, whether there is a responsibility inherent in poetry or not.
But it's so much of political discourse is kind of reductive, and it's the sloganeering to sort of make things simple. I can remember people sort of saying back in the days of like Brexit campaigning, it's simply a matter of sovereignty or something like that. It's or just like a yes, no vote, even the way in which you're building a wall, whatever it is, just like these kind of very like childish kind of basic reductive things. Like poetry is kind of, isn't it, a kind of
it's a propaganda in favour of complexity, maybe, or openness, or
that's good. Ambivalence. I think I'd sign up for that. That's nice.
I don't think the trains just sort of show up whenever, you know.
I'll vote for that position.
Yeah. I mean, or maybe at least it's kind of seems like it might be a kind of a safeguard. And there's that awful
against that kind of oversimplification.
I think it's weird that when you think the poetry is kind of enjoying a bit of a boom at the moment, but you can see the real awkwardness with which sort of mainstream media or any kind of media kind of interacts with it. It still can't really talk about poems. It finds that basically impossible.
And it's happier with poems that do sound like sloganeering. You know, it's happier with the poems that simplify rather than problematize.
Yeah, or if they can find a narrative, a biographical narrative. Yes.
Anything avoids, speaking about the actual poem, or reproducing the poem in the newspaper. I love it when poets have a fight. They like that. That's always a good news. Yeah. I don't know why that's because poets fight all the time.
Yeah, there's good feuds. You've got to have a few feuds going. Have you got a few feuds going? Rachel?
Only with you.
Only with me. I see that more as a marriage.
Yeah. Well, that's a feud.
You don't have to name any names. I think it's just healthy. I've got about five ongoing sort of feuds in my mind. They're completely in my own mind.
Well, feuds, I guess, to talk about poetic feuds or like feuds in poetry is kind of interesting because it's how poets position themselves, and it usually comes down to sort of ideas of politics. And I find that, you know, people are so, well, previously when you read manifestos or talks on craft, people are so desperate to make claims to what poetry is. Poetry has to be this thing. Poetry has to declare this or be in this model. And I think maybe that's just a natural instinct to try and define the very nebulous thing that we're all working within, but also completely impossible. So feuds can be intellectually interesting in that way, but also very dull when it's just sort of two poets snipping at each other on Twitter about something or other. But perhaps it all comes down to the fact that one person inherently believes that poetry should be doing one thing, and another believes that it should be doing other.
Yeah, I mean, in the United States, and it may be true in Britain too, there's been, for a long time at least, I think this has ceased to be true, but there was kind of a split in poetry that started with the New American Poets, and the Beats, and the San Francisco Renaissance, et cetera. So there was kind of a split between the sort of maverick poets and, you know, the raw and the cooked, I guess you could say. Not that the New American Poets were actually so raw as all that, but that was the way it was presented then. And so there was that kind of split. And then in, I guess, the 1970s and 1980s, the typical mainstream poem that was published in the big venues was a short narrative poem that, you know, told an anecdote that sort of had a moral. I'm being reductive now, but I was on the other side.
What's wrong with Billy Collins? Yeah, I like a bit of Billy.
He makes you laugh. I know. Well, he's not terrible.
I like him. He's good.
But, you know, I don't want to get into specific.
No.
You know, but there are poets who, you know, weren't so good.
You can if you want.
We're just talking about feuds. I mean, come on. No. The sort of poetry wars, I think, is that what
that was the term. So there were groups like the second generation New York school poets, like the, I hate this name that I'm labeled with, but the so-called language poets, who served the purpose at least of breaking up the dominance of that paradigm. And now I think in the United States it's a little bit hard to find a single mainstream. It's, you know, lots of things are permissible, lots of things are happening.
Okay, so Don, would you like to read us a couple of poems or one
I'll
other
just
poem?
Read one. Trust me, I'll be more than enough. So this is another one of these Twilight Zone things. It's called Death. His trick, by which I mean the way he'd convince you of his earnestness, was to actualize at some random and unpredictable post, unruffled, immaculate, like he'd been there all along, vaping at the turn of the stairs, taking a piss in the adjacent stall, or turning round from the seat in front in the empty matinee, saying, "Come on, we've been through this." And again, I'd get up and leave and mutter, "I'm not ready yet." And he'd say, "Okay, bud, see you tonight," knowing we all got worn down by this in the end. Before they kicked me upstairs, I used to work in sales. I still have a case of free samples and an eye for an easy mark. One day, he was working through some genre clichés to keep himself amused, and I was closing the bathroom cabinet when I saw him at my shoulder. I shrieked. He cracked up laughing. I swung round and we fell into the usual threadbare exchange. But I caught him running the back of his hand across my Pima cotton towels and sneak a sidelong look at my new sonic toothbrush with more than just a casual interest. I noticed his Prada suit was a size too large and his floral tea cologne was Tommy Girl, though it smelt pretty good on him. It was then I really saw it, his weakness. I said, "Look, look, I'll do you a deal." "No deals," he says, "you know that." "Hear me out," I say, "it's legit. Give me another 20 years and I'll kick you out. I'll be your go-to guy. I'm serious. Knock down rates." He said nothing, but the sweat was forming in his upper lip and brow. So I got out the case and did my old routine, told him I'm practically giving this stuff away, though it was tough to see him so easily played, so easily reduced. So worried and frantic, me pulling out one thing after another, him suddenly wondering if he could afford it all, patting his pockets, wondering if I took plastic, wondering if he had plastic, what plastic even was, his arms full of all the cool new things he wanted, a black fedora, a snakeskin belt, the silk tie with a Mondrian design. But then realising that he was technically neither salaried nor self-employed, a slave to his work, he'd always thought, but really just a slave, hand-to-mouth, hardly ever in the same town two nights in a row, sleeping on couches between gigs, everything he wore lifted from the closets of the dead, everything he ate wherever the dead had left uneaten on the stove after he'd walked him to the car. All he wanted was a night off, a table at Clio so he could work through the card, and then to go home to his own shit, some old jazz and vinyl, a valve amplifier, a good espresso machine and a workout bike, and maybe a wife and kids too in time. But whenever he thought of them, or rather what they'd talk about around the big TV at the kitchen table as he made his famous chili at the school gate after hockey practice, all he could ever think of was him delivering the bad news as usual, the worst. "Daddy, what do you mean I must leave with you now?" Don't think for a second that death loves his work. Even though I couldn't stop, we both knew there was no way he could pay for any of this stuff. I was holding back the tears for him. Who wants to see their own death fall to such a two-bit hustle? In the end, I gave up. I hugged him. I said, "Honestly, it's okay, it's okay. I'll go with you. Just give me five to get some things and say goodbye to folks." And he was fine with that and so innocently grateful when I really did come back, carrying a near-new pair of brogues, a couple of good shirts, and a nice blue jacket that I reckoned would fit him well. And I can see in his eyes that over the years, he'd lost more than a few of us this way, to this old play, and each of us had cost him like a life.
Well, thank you. Ray, would you like to read us a couple more poems as well?
Oh, should I read something that mentions plants like we were talking about, or should I follow up on his dark mood?
Let's read some plants and some dark mood. A mixture of both.
Okay. All right. Well, this one is called Sparks. Sharp green flames of weeds give off occasional yellow flowers. Weeds aren't flames. They're God's tongues, translucent, invasive, to flicker, to sink down and spring up, to thrust, to be the air and also be the sun. Now I have to think what else I could read. All right, I got one for you. Speaking of capitalism and speaking of dark. If I can find it. Here we go. Hate. The market hates itself just as much as you hate it. Look, in this spread for leather products, a stern-faced man in pink pants and a bomber jacket stands on satin sheets in front of leopard print wallpaper holding a small briefcase or purse. The market hates you even more than you hate yourself.
Thank you so much. And just to, I guess, a couple final questions to sort of see us out as well, just to see if we can work them in. Ray, we heard an amazing paper last night by Jonathan Skinner, broadly about your sort of ecological concerns and sort of how to situate your poems in an Anthropocene time. Mm-hmm. And it's been interesting to me to see the sort of evolution of your poetry and these concerns with ecological spaces and the non-human grow and become almost more direct. And it was interesting to hear you talk about this last night in terms of sort of hope and cynicism as to how we approach sort of climate crisis, the language that we use to address it, and the things that we utilise in our poems. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about sort of that in your work.
Yeah. Well, that is something that is so important and so obvious, at least where I live in the American West, on the West Coast, which is now always on fire. That sounds like a joke, but it's pretty much literally true. California's fire season is half the year now. Forests are burning. And now I've moved to the Pacific Northwest, but last summer, there were 3 weeks where you couldn't see the sun or the sky for the smoke. It was coming from British Columbia. It was coming from Oregon. It was coming from Eastern Washington. The fires, and this is just focusing on fire, is just one thing you could focus on, but the fires are coming more and more often. They used to say that fire is part of the evergreen forest ecosystem, and it needs fire, which is true, but it doesn't need fire every 10 years or every 5 years, not a massive fire anyway. So in some places, they're wondering if the forests can even regenerate. This was true in Southern California. There are some forests on mountains, and I lived in San Diego most of my life, and just east of San Diego, there is a relatively small mountain range, but it had a pine forest on it, and a lot of that burned. Not all of it, but a lot, and it's not regenerating. It's going to turn into brushland because of climate change and because of how frequent the fires were and also because of drought. And so I have read some books about it, but you don't have to read books because it's coming right at us. And so I'm the grandmother of two-year-old twin girls now, and I know that sounds sentimental, but when you see little children and you think about how the world they grow up in is going to be increasingly toxic and depleted, it does weigh on your mind.
There's the sort of idea of the rhetoric of climate crisis that really saturates us in the media and sort of, government advertisements or whatever. And then there's the climate crisis that you see all around you and that you're surrounded by, which for your situation sounds really severe and extreme. Mm-hmm. We see it here just from flooding and extra hot flooding. Summers and things like that. But I think it's been a real visible concern, especially in your newer poems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that it becomes a question of how to write about that because, the fact of climate change is well known and obvious to most people, at least most of the people who would read poetry, even though there are still some climate change deniers, but we don't need to go there. So, I don't want to preach to the converted. I don't want to bang people over the head. But so what's interesting to me is to write about the ways in which we can deceive ourselves and in which we can think, oh, that's bad, but that's later, or, the way we can look away. And it's not just from this issue, but this issue's one area in which we do that, in which we cordon ourselves off from what we're actually doing, right?
That's what makes your work, I think, really necessary, because it's not just addressing a sort of ecological space, it's addressing the human within that space and the human reaction to climate crisis. And also, I think your use of science and your understanding of science provides a kind of inflection in the poetry of sort of different ways in which we can look at ecological spaces that aren't just a sort of a romanticization of them, which is another thing that I think makes your poetry really necessary when thinking about eco-poetry or poetry in terms of the Anthropocene.
Thank you. It's not that Wobble is all that, because none of my books are all about one thing. But I did almost discover as writing it, and also the new manuscript that I have just finished, that it kept coming back. So there are a number of poems in the book that play with them. Play is the wrong word, but that address that somehow. enough maybe to give the book, if not a theme, then a motif, recurring motif.
And you have a new book next year, Don?
Yeah.
What have you found you've been interrogating or sort of working with, if you can? I mean, you don't have to thematize it in any way, but
those two poems are a really brilliant flavor of what it's going to be.
The new book is based on, I think I mentioned, the first season of The Twilight Zone.
Oh, yeah.
And very few of the poems make direct reference to the episodes. But I used them as kind of prompts to write about things otherwise would have been too cowardly to approach, I think, you know. Because I don't sort of, you know, I like to kind of, you know, I don't like writing about myself much.
Helped you having that as a kind of framework then, or a soundboard, having these sort of episodes to work from?
Yeah, it gave me a sort of bizarre kind of excuse, you know, to write something that was kind of like a sort of, you know, magic realist autobiographical kind of approach to the thing, you know. I don't know if it'll be of any... I don't know if it's any good, like, you know, but it was kind of fun to write. And also, I just finished this big treatise about poetry and mostly about sort of formal stuff. And I just felt like I never wanted to write another bloody sonnet again, you know? I even read one, you know. So I thought I need to find something a bit kind of more accommodating and kind of freer. And so I just got into writing this kind of long C.K. Williams-y kind of long line thing.
Long poems. I think that's...
Yeah. Are they long? They feel like long lines. Yeah.
They all go over to the next line. That's the only thing they have in common. But they're not particularly metrical. Yay. I may be done with that forever.
Do you think you can be done with preoccupations? Do you think you can be... Because I often think... I remember, I won't say who it was, but I arrived late to a poet's reading, and they were reading these longer prose things. And when it came to the Q&A, I said, they really reminded me of Elizabeth Bishop, who I knew was a poet that this person admired. And I thought about this. There was lots of discussion of water, and there was something about, so I don't know, something fish housey about it. and they said, oh, I introduced them saying that I've been trying to get away from Elizabeth Bishop. I felt like it was such a dick
move.
I don't think
you escape anything. I think you add to the range of things that you can do. And because, you know, your time's finite, sometimes it means moving away from them for some time, but you still have them in your kind of bag of tricks. Mm. I stopped playing music for about 12 years, and I've just gone back to that, you know, sort of professionally in the last 4 years again, but I had 12 years off it. But I kind of knew at some point I'd go back to it. And I think it's the same with anything like that. You know, you can always go back to earlier versions of yourself. They're intact if you acquire them for a particular kind of purpose, political, rhetorical, whatever. They're all there. But hopefully you do add kind of stuff as you go on. You know,
context changes as well.
That's right. And so, you know, and as you change, so your tricks have to change as your environment changes, you know.
It's been an absolute pleasure to have you both in the studio, Rayanne Montrell and Don Patterson. Thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
The last section of my poetry collection, Garden Physic, consists of a series of poems that respond to Pedanius Dioscorides' Materia Medica. He was a physician and botanist in 1st century AD Greece, and he compiled what was essentially the first comprehensive pharmacopoeia, and it had medicinal remedies that were not only plant-based, but also derived from stones and minerals and metals and animals and sea creatures. I'm going to read three very short poems that are about plants that are contained in Materia Medica. Rhubarb. Great esculent garden. Wisdom's sharp companion. Patient rhubarb. Wild rhubarb. Beyond the Bosporus. Beyond the pies lost in a triangle of midsummer scruples. Ginger and spikenard, a dram of no misgivings, a drop of caution under Mars. Sea lavender. On the lake lip, by the abdominal swamp, in the sub-cosmopolis bog, limnal leaves in tufts, marsh rosemary, wild marsh beet of red seed, ink root. For ancient ulcers, for current events and topical discharge, A drink of wine dark, limonium and sea. A glass of sea thrift and wine. Rue. A ring of rue around the neck. A chaplet of rue. Rue the tears of a weeping queen. Fill a house with rue to kill the fleas. Rue of contradiction and incongruity. Rue vehement and full of grace. Rue broody and distilled. Rue impassioned and brewed. Rue the rue that repeats itself. Once more the vinegar of the aforesaid four thieves. The rue that dodged contagion. The rue that robbed with impunity.
So we have almost three separate poems, three little poems here. There's the first thing that strikes me about these is like the qualifiers. This is like top descriptor game, isn't it? You've got like an esculent garden. What else have you got?
And the thing that always amazes me about Sylvia Legree is the way that she will sort of put words together, like bodily words, alongside botanical words. So Garden Physic, I think this book that's about to come out from her, maybe this year or next year from New Directions, it's all about plants and like she has this poetry that's kind of an invasive botany, an invasive linguistic botany, which she gets like deep into the body of the plant. And not only does she get sort of deep into the body of the plant, but she like dissects the language that's also dissecting the plant. So like for a poem about sea lavender, to say things like abdominal swamp and subcosmopolis bog, limnal leaves in tuft, marsh rosemary. Like, she has this kind of associative power that's not actually describing the thing that the poem is titled. It's more just this kind of like, it's almost like when you smell something and you're trying to describe the smell. It's like all the associations that the smell brings.
Well, I think when you put a usual descriptor next to something that refers to like the things, ordinary material reality. So if it's like a scaly fish, your brain doesn't do any work. You're like, because this fish has scales. But when you have something like, I don't know, even something like topical discharge, which makes kind of logical sense, that's like a kind of new combination. There's real tension in these, those like combinations, and there's work to do. There's always like these, and musically that she's just kind of like laying these things down.
And I'll sometimes teach her poems, and she's got this pamphlet called Pneumatic Antiphonal, which is all about bird song, but it's about sort of how bird song comes to be in a material way. So she'll describe like the processes of a bird's throat, or the processes of like a human ear, what a human ear has to go to hear bird song. And often they'll be about bird song particularly. And I often say to students, if you take away the title of this poem, do you know what it's about? And for these poems, I feel exactly the same. If you were to hear this stanza for ancient ulcers, for current events and topical discharge, a drink of wine, dark limonium and sea, you wouldn't say sea lavender, which is perhaps like a usual poem fodder to write about plants, but she's managed to like sort of really reenact how we think about botany and how we think about plants.
It's so deep in the sort of ontology, isn't it? It's like so deep in the sort of the being of the thing, or the thingness of the thing, that it's not really the thing as you encounter it. It's something else.
There's a materiality to her poetry that I'm not entirely sure how she manages to create that materiality and to make it feel like we are in the plant or in the body of the human. So her book before this, The Hideous Hidden, is all about human dissection and human bodies. And there's a way that she just manages to like build a figure and build a material being while also dissecting how that's represented to us through language.
Yeah.
It's so amazing.
I love in the Rue poem, the last one that she read, with the way that anaphora, the Rue of contradiction and the Rue vehement and full of grace, Rue broody and distilled, Rue like it just sort of, it occupies a place of sound. It's R-U-E, isn't it? We checked, rather than like, I don't know, kangaroo, whatever. And the way that sort of, largely it's like occupies this place of sound, this word rue. And again, so you're like trying to figure out what it is, but you're also, you abort the project of thinking about it, what it is, because you just trust what it is. What it is newly through the poem.
The foregrounding of like sound for sound's sake.
Yeah.
And sound integral to meaning, and her language play, it always like refreshes me. Her poetry, it's some kind of experiment and practice, but it's more than that, so much more than that as well.
It reminds me of like Lisa Janot, who also has that kind of like, I really feel like it's a sort of like almost like a holiness to the work, that kind of like, yeah, that like cleaning, because the language is being used so sort of playfully. So
it feels that like there's nothing necessarily being told, it's all just stated. It feels like there's just a picture. I don't know, it's hard to describe it. It feels like there's a picture being made. It's so image-led, but through language. And it's so complex behind these, you know, quite brilliant, stark images. There's a real complexity.
There's almost a sort of like when music is returned to the, when language is returned to that music of just sort of feeling, and when you're sort of occupying like that musicality in a very sort of like immediate, not like lesser, the primacy of the cerebral sort of it goes away. That is kind of like churchy, that kind of like there's a kind of, I don't know, you're just...
sacredness.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like, you know, and also with you. You know, it's like when you say the Lord's Prayer and you don't believe in God, but you still feel like good to say.
Totally.
I loved her reading of these, but I can't wait to get into, you know, a darkened wardrobe on my own and say them.
Chant them to yourself.
Exactly. I think they're gonna do some proper healing.
Yeah.
And now for our final audio postcard, a poem by Zayar Lynn, translated by Coco Thet.
Slightly lopsided, but a more accurate portrait by Zayar Lynn, translated by Coco Thet. I am an idiot, just kidding. I am an idiot with a brain like a seismograph recording of the earthquake only after the disaster, with laughter breaking out far beyond the joke. Imbecile. In that word, there is half my family name. Part of the tongue always wanting to lick a running chainsaw. Thought of decayed ship timber at the sea bottom, the eye patch of a pirate captain. That's where my granddad grew up, in the goddamned language his head was rested. The A, B, and C of the vacuum, that's where I hang out. Am I a nitwit? Impossible. There is no such word in my ancestors' dictionary. I no longer know myself. Rowing a whole ridden boat with my survivor oars, left after right, right after left. Cannot be two lefts and two rights at the same time. I might wobble, but I am not that insane. They say, I'm not even a full chat. They say I'm worth just 90 PRs. No one is coming up to haggle with me. Not anymore. The earth-eating giant has been pulling my rights one after another, measuring them up in his palm. He will trash the short ones. He will slash the tall ones, just like some philatelists. He collects rights. This, he says, is his hobby. That doesn't harm anyone. So, am I an imbecile? Am I an idiot? The scheme has been so thorough. Now that we are far away from the feeder, let's go back to the field. There's a harrowing ghost in the skin where I live. The grand music I have carried has been dropped and cracked. Someone has forgotten to say something, so they say a number of stitches. So they say, I no longer know myself. What a genuine idiot, imbecile, nincompoop I am. No, 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 that's not true. I don't know who has been putting these speeches in my mouth. You idiot! You, who will marry your own corpse.
You've been listening to the Faber Poetry Podcast, presented by Jack Underwood and Rachel Allen, produced by Jack Underwood, Rachel Allen, and Hannah Marshall for Faber and Faber. You can listen to us on all your favourite podcast platforms, and don't forget to tell your friends and subscribe.
Ray, is there a real song that goes, I'm not a baby, wah, wah, wah?
No.
Oh. do you have a tune in mind?
If I had to sing it, I can't sing at all. So that would be really embarrassing. It'd be kind of like, I'm not a baby, wah, wah, wah.
That's perfect. That's good. That's me. That's my day made.